Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt has spent his first year on the job leading a campaign to reverse a slew of mostly Obama-era environmental policies and rules. He's not a fan of the agency he leads. The former Oklahoma Attorney General, in fact, repeatedly sued the EPA over rules regulating mercury, smog, and other forms of pollution. At the heart of the campaign is Pruitt's doubts about climate change science and the role of humans in the buildup of greenhouse gases. But questionable spending and management practices have caught the attention of Congress and put Pruitt on the hot seat in testimony on Capitol Hill three times in less than a month. Coming up, we'll drill down into the history of climate change denial. Joining us right now by phone is New York Times energy and environmental policy reporter Coral Davenport, who has been covering Pruitt. Welcome back, Coral.
Hi, great to be with you.
There have been three hearings in less than a month. What have they covered?
Well, actually, those hearings were standard hearings that EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt would have been required to go to on the Hill anyway. They were just regular budget hearings. Usually they would probably be kind of a snore. Every cabinet head has to just go to Congress and justify their budget. In this case, they were really hot button hearings because of this cascade of sort of endless questions about Scott Pruitt's spending, his management, the conclusion by one government investigation that he has broken the law at least once in purchasing a $43,000 secure phone booth for his office, questions about spending hundreds of thousands of dollars of taxpayer money on first-class travel to places like Morocco, where the EPA has no official business. So those also kind of fall under the rubric, under the category of spending. And that was really, those questions really ended up being the focus of what the members of Congress were asking about.
Is the questioning during these hearings, these otherwise perfunctory hearings, is it being led by Democrats or Republicans?
Well, you know, Republicans have the majority. So they get to lead off the questioning, and it is starkly partisan. You know, before the first hearing, which was on the House side at the end of April, we started to kind of hear this buildup of real concern on the part of Republicans, concern and criticism, who said, you know, these allegations, these investigations, the conclusion that he broke the law had kind of seemed to get to the point where Republicans were saying, yeah, we do have to ask him some tough questions. And we were expecting a surprising moment maybe where Republicans would kind of turn on one of their own and really force him to answer tough questions. That did not happen. At the end of the day, in all three hearings, Republicans sort of opened with a little slap on the wrist saying, look, these questions about your management practices are getting in the way of all the good policy work you're doing, and let's ask about that. That was sort of the tone. So Republicans really did not go after Pruitt. They did not ask him tough questions. They did not put his feet to the fire. Democrats did. You know, they hammered him. They also spent a lot of time grandstanding, just sort of telling him what a bad guy he was, mm-hmm. which, you know, that allows Democrats to sort of put in their sound bites and sound good. But it doesn't really, I don't know how many strong blows they actually landed. I think they did a lot of grandstanding and criticizing. At the end of the day, I don't know. You know, we thought these hearings might really sort of tear Pruitt down, and if he couldn't get through them, he might end up losing his job. But the questioning I don't think landed any lethal blows. And you know, of course, it's, you know, more than a week has gone by since the last one, and he still has his job.
Mm-hmm. We've heard though that Republicans on the Hill and in the White House have kind of wanted to see Pruitt go.
That's absolutely true. Certainly in the White House at the staff level, a lot of senior staff are just really sick of the fact that these ethical questions about Pruitt are nonstop. I think if there had been just one or just two and it had died away, that would have been fine. But there's now a really strong sense that these questions, you know, these questions and reports keep coming, and there's a sense it's not going to stop. And this guy is going to be such a distraction and such a source of criticism. And he, in so many ways, these allegations exemplify what President Trump purported to be campaigning against, the swamp, mm-hmm. you know, corruption, you know, this Washington insiderism, using a public office for personal gain. And so certainly within the White House, what we're hearing is that senior staffers have kind of renewed a push to get the president to fire Pruitt or force him to resign. And, you know, other cabinet secretaries have been forced to step down for far less. Pruitt is
exactly.
under 12 investigations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, former Health and Human Service Secretary Tom Price had to step down just because of, you know, one problem of overspending on fancy flights. You know, mm-hmm. Pruitt has that times 12.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the president still hasn't, you know, still has publicly said that he likes him and he likes what he's doing.
Well, he is carrying out, at least trying to carry out actively, aggressively reversing regulations in the EPA that Trump called for during the campaign.
He is, but that's a little more nuanced. There's no question that Pruitt has made the initial filings on rolling back over 24 environmental regulations. That's huge. We've never seen anything like that, you know, efforts to roll back that many regulations in such a short period of time. And that, of course, that is a signature issue for President Trump. It's what he ran on.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what he means when he says he likes the work product.
Mm-hmm.
But look more closely. One of the things that's remarkable about that is how many regulatory rollbacks he's doing in such a short period of time. Well, one reason we haven't seen that done so quickly, even in Republican administrations that don't like environmental regulations, is that experts who are looking at this say this is being done so shoddily.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of these rollbacks, all of these have to go through the courts. Almost all of them will end up having to go to the Supreme Court. They'll all have to be defended. And a lot of these are just being pushed out the door. You know, I've heard people, I've talked to experts who've looked at these, and they say these are just cut and paste jobs. They
mm-hmm.
they haven't done good legal or technical analysis. Already, six of those efforts have been struck down by the court. And there's a strong sense that a lot more of those efforts have just been done so badly. They've been done in order to get that announcement that pleases President Trump, that you know, big press release to sort of tout those numbers. But that at the end of the day, there's a question as to how much of this is actually going to stick.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the work of EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt since he took office last year. There's been a lot of concern about allegations of ethical breaches and bad spending, bad management. But also he has been working to undo the EPA on many levels. My guest is Coral Davenport. She covers the agency for The New York Times as an energy and environmental policy reporter. She says that, well, yeah, he's been plowing ahead with these to undo these regulations at the EPA, but that they're being blocked every which way because of the science. And I read that one regulation that he wanted to relax regulations on emissions from coal burning power plants or storage of residue from coal burning power plants was based on a 4-page. Paper by the Edison Institute, which is the body representing the utilities.
Electric utilities,
yeah.
Exactly. And that is turning into sort of Pruitt's signature way of doing business. Another big rollback that he did was a rollback on auto emissions. And mm-hmm. for that, they did a 30-page justification, which was basically a cut and paste job from objections by the auto industry. So they just took, you know, public comments filed by the auto industry describing why this regulation was onerous to them, this EPA regulation. The EPA, in rolling back that regulation, cut and pasted directly a lot of those comments into a document and filed that and said, well, this is the reason we're not going to do this. And by comparison, when the Obama administration put forth that original regulation on auto emissions, they filed a 1,112-page document that was chock full of, you know, legal, economic, scientific, technical analysis explaining and justifying why this regulation was necessary. So, you know, and the courts look at these when they say, well, you know, you should be, if you're going to say that regulation is not necessary, you kind of need a similar set of documents as opposed to just sort of, well, the auto industry doesn't like it and here's what they say.
Well, let me ask you this, Coral Davenport, do they not exist? I mean, is there not the science out there to support their deregulation efforts? Are they just Bush League? Do they not know how to do their jobs or what?
There's a lot of things going on. One reason is that they're trying to put forth these regulatory rollbacks very quickly.
Yeah.
You know, the Obama vehicle emissions regulation was more than 2 years in the making. And they had a lot of staff kind of working day and night to prepare these justifications. This EPA is trying to do, you know, these rollbacks, you know, sometimes every 2 weeks. They're doing them very quickly. They've already cut a lot of staff. They've lost a lot of staff. And a lot of the career staff at EPA are not being included in these decisions. You know, these are career staff in a lot of cases who wrote a lot of the regulations that the administrator now wants to roll back. So instead of relying on the career staff, they're just relying on a very small circle of, you know, handpicked political staff to do these big, complicated legal steps extremely quickly. So they don't really have the expertise that they need. They're trying to do these things really quickly. And one of the criticisms from people who look at this and people from inside the administration say, what they really want here is sort of a big announcement saying they've done a rollback. Mm-hmm. And if that doesn't work out in the courts a few years later, well, Pruitt himself might be long gone by then.
When they go to court, who takes them to court? Who's paying for the court, you know, for the legal defense of the regulations against Pruitt and the Trump administration?
In most cases, the states. For example, the states of California and New York have sued the EPA on most of its regulatory rollbacks. And they're usually joined by most other states with Democratic governors. So that the states with Democratic governors or Democratic attorneys general are working together. The two big powerhouses are California and New York. So I think California has sued the EPA at least 11 times. And they work together. So that's kind of the big group that that gets ready to fight back each time.
Well, Coral, thanks for joining us again. I appreciate your time.
Oh, sure. It's great to be with you. Thanks so much for having me.
Coral Davenport, New York Times energy and environmental policy reporter. She covers the Pruitt administration and the EPA. Coming up, we're going to talk about the science of environmental policy, in particular climate change, and you know, what works, what doesn't, and what's working in the Pruitt administration. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Scott Pruitt spent his first year as Environmental Protection Agency administrator leading a campaign to reverse mostly Obama-era environmental policies and protections. As a former Oklahoma attorney general, he repeatedly sued the EPA for its efforts to regulate mercury, smog, and other forms of pollution. Now, Pruitt is testifying on Capitol Hill amid increasing allegations of legal and ethical misconduct. And this is all while the issue of climate change continues to divide the country. Joining us is Professor, Associate Professor of Communication, Political Science, and Environmental Policy at Ohio State School of Communication, Eric Nisbet. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
And by phone, economist Nicholas Loris. He focuses on energy, environmental, and regulatory issues at the Heritage Foundation. Welcome to the show, Nicholas.
Thank you. Good morning.
Nicholas, can you just give us a baseline here about the Heritage Foundation's position on the role of humans in climate change, if climate change is a real thing? I mean, is there a specific position that the Heritage Foundation takes?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we certainly believe that man-made emissions are playing a role in changing the climate and warming the planet. It's quite clear that over the past few decades, really since 1950, you've seen a dramatic increase in greenhouse gas emissions, primarily CO2, but others, that have resulted in an increase in warming that is likely more than 50% of the warming since that time period. That said, what we believe is that there's still a lot of differing science on what that warming will do in the future, looking at what a doubling of CO2 emissions means for global temperatures moving forward. There's a lot of climate science out there that says it's closer to 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming rather than, you know, the high end of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's estimates, which are anywhere from 4.5 to 6 degrees Celsius. So, yes, the climate is warming, but we're not headed towards this catastrophic state that many purport we are. And most importantly, from a policy organization, we feel that a lot of the policies, whether it's a carbon tax or cap and trade or the Clean Power Plan, would impose huge economic costs for negligible climate benefits.
So as far as how the EPA is run, Nicholas, should it be based on science or should it be run more like it has been in the past year in concert with industry that it regulates?
No, it should be based on objective, transparent science. And, you know, that's why I think former Obama administration official Steve Koonin's idea of a red team, blue team debate was pretty interesting to me, because then you have scientists on both sides of the aisle discussing the severity of climate change, its impact on natural disasters, on sea level rise, you know, all of those things that we're concerned about, and therefore a regulatory agency should take a look at. That's where the policy should be based on. It should be based on good science. It shouldn't be based on industry, and it shouldn't be based on environmental activist organizations who want to shut down the use of conventional energy. I think it should be based on objective, transparent science.
I think the Washington Post reported that the Pruitt administration wanted to also have a red team, blue team debate, but that the Trump White House put the kibosh on that. How do you feel about that, Nicholas Loris?
Well, I think if we're going to try to have some consensus about where we are on climate change, as you mentioned, it's such a polarizing topic in the United States, more likely here than any other country in the world. I think the more people understand the science and try to get to the bottom of what's reality versus what's speculation and what's grounded in good fundamental science versus what's not, then people may start to trust Washington and the climate science a little more. You won't have this notion that we are going to see Manhattan underwater anytime soon, but we also won't hear, hopefully, more of the, you know, climate change is a hoax and that it's not real. I think there's a very consensus-based middle ground in there somewhere, and there's obviously a lot of differing opinions within that consensus. That's the real heart of the issue, and then we need to focus on what those regulatory actions should or should not be.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the issue of climate change. What does it mean politically? How has it come to the fore? My guest, you just heard from Nicholas Loris. He's an economist. He focuses on energy, environmental, and regulatory issues at the Heritage Foundation. Also with us, Eric Nisbet. He's an OSU professor of communication, political science, and environmental policy in the School of Communication. Eric Nisbet, from what you've looked at this issue, how did it emerge as a political debate? I remember writing about it for a column when I was covering the State House back in the early 90s. It started to come out that Republicans tended to oppose environmental regulation and Democrats supported it. I know I'm oversimplifying, but what's your view of it?
Well, it's been a long-term trend, and there's been some key milestones along the way. I think really you saw the environment becoming an increasing wedge issue on the left, right in the 1980s, right? And when Reaganism came in and viewing the idea of sort of a regulation rollback from the 1970s, there was a lot of consensus.
Which is when Richard Nixon established the EPA.
Right. There was a lot of consensus in the 1970s about clean water, clean air, for example. You had landmark legislation in the 1970s. And then you started to have a pushback in the 1980s, and this continued into the 90s. I think you also have to look at the environment. Is one of many issues we become increasingly polarized about. So
okay.
It's not in a vacuum, right? And climate change is part of that. Another key milestone, so we had increasingly the environmental regulation becoming more and more of a wedge issue in the 80s into the 90s. And then you had the Kyoto Treaty in the late 1990s, right? And really and it's this interaction between left and right, right? It's not all driven by the right. It's not all driven by the left. It's them interacting with each other, each for their own sort of partisan purposes. For example, you had the Kyoto Treaty, and when the Clinton administration went out and wanted to do communication about it and sort of get credit for it among its Democratic base, that also furthered polarization because if one side sort of takes credit and says this is great for us, the other side might think, well, maybe it's not so good for us as well on the right. So you actually saw a flip where you saw actually some among the public, there was actually sort of some consensus for support for the Kyoto Treaty prior to a campaign, communications campaign by the Clinton administration to promote it. And once they actually got involved and promoted it and very much from a political perspective to gain support among liberals, you actually saw this sort of divergent polarization among the public about it. Other milestones, of course, are, you know, the Inconvenient Truth. And that actually, though, I think is a key polarizing moment because
the film by former Vice President Al Gore.
Right, exactly. You took the presidential candidate from until that time, one of the most polarizing and closest sort of presidential campaigns, and made him sort of the poster child for climate change. Now, that obviously increased the salience and the importance of climate change along a wide a segment of the population. It really mobilized liberals and progressives, environmentalists on the issue of climate change. But it is not surprising that there was eventual pushback against that when, again, you took someone who is inherently political and sort of linked that to a scientific issue. At the same time, it's not just the you know efforts by environmental organizations or liberals to put climate change on the agenda. You also had a pushback, a concerted pushback against climate change, both the science and the policy, by a range of institutional actors post Inconvenient Truth in 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010, where we had a lot of money pouring in to support political candidates on the right to oppose climate change or the consensus on climate change science. You had a lot of funding going to organizations like the Heartland Institute. So it's this sort of back and forth seesaw that has sort of created this polarization in this context of greater polarization in general.
Nicholas Loris, in your opinion, who are the stakeholders here? You mentioned the liberal environmental groups, which I'm trying to figure out what do they have to gain personally. I'm trying to figure out who are the stakeholders.
Gain is the demonization of fossil fuels in a lot of senses, and you've seen that play out in a number of debates at the state and regional level, as well as a lot of these environmental organizations working with renewable energy companies who would stand to benefit from significantly regulating the use of coal, oil, and gas. In Washington State, for instance, there was a debate over a carbon tax, which would have been probably the most aggressive climate policy in North America. And the tax revenue would have been, under the ballot initiative, rebated back to the people. And it was opposed by most environmental organizations and renewable energy groups because the money wasn't being rebated back to those renewable energy groups. And so I think there's certainly some sort of financial play at stake here for some of these organizations, as well as some of the larger utilities as well. We saw that back in the cap and trade debates in 2008 and 2009, where a lot of the utilities were gaming the system to try and work with legislators to write the legislation to protect their bottom line, not necessarily worried about the consumers and energy using businesses. So I think, like most of politics, you know, climate change has become politicized in ways that will help pad the bottom lines of either impacted industries that will stand to benefit from such regulations or ones that may be hurt, but hurt less so than their competitors.
So is there anybody out there who just cares about the environment for the sake of the future of humankind?
Oh, absolutely. And I don't mean to, I think there's a lot of those environmental organizations that are out there. I certainly am not trying to question the motive of them all. I think there's folks who are significantly worried about the future of climate change and global warming and its impact on the planet and society as a whole. And I think that's a very fine position to take. That said, I do think there's a role to question some of the science that purports that we're headed toward climate catastrophe. And so, therefore, I think that's when this has become more of a religion in a lot of senses for both the left and the right. And therefore, it's hard to talk to one another, and people tend to talk past one another, and their minds have been already made up that we are going to some sort of climate catastrophe or that climate change is a hoax, and you can't really have that meaningful, productive dialogue that we should have in the intersection of science and public policy.
I just want to add, I agree with some of that. I think climate change has become what I like to say is an identity marker for defining who, if you're a Republican or Democrat, liberal or conservative, climate change has become one of those issues, almost like abortion, that defines who you are, which tribe you belong to. And so it has created difficulty in having productive conversations. In terms of climate impacts, I would simply say that, you know, one of the mantras I think about when climate change is hope for the best, prepare for the worst, right? So, you know, though we can talk about and the models looking at the impact of climate change are less certain, there is less consensus as compared to that climate change is happening, that it's human induced. I think there,
but what'll happen in the long run,
the overall consensus is that though there will be climate winners and losers overall globally, then that impact of climate change will be negative for the planet and for most. We're already seeing impacts in Ohio. You know, we talked to farmers and they're preparing for inclement weather when they're going to have more torrential rain or different growing seasons. It's going to have an impact on everyday life in many ways. And so what we can do is, you know, take precautions to limit its impact and have, I guess, and we do need to have a wider debate. I agree with that. I think, you know, on the idea that climate change is a hoax is not productive. And the idea that renewables is the only way to address climate change is not productive. We need an all of the above type of strategy.
Yeah, all
right?
Of the above is very popular. Yeah. You know, Nicholas Lewis, when I wanted to talk about the footing of, you know, the environmental groups versus industry, which are the big, you know, leaders in on one side of the equation, at least, when the utilities, most of the utilities, I would say, when most of the coal mines, when most of the oil drilling started back in the day that built these massive fortunes and huge conglomerates in the end, there was very little regulation. There was very little holding them back. Are the environmentalists of today on any kind of equal footing with the industries that they're working against purportedly anyway?
Yeah, I think so. And I think in a lot of senses, they're on greater footing. And you saw that was true within the last administration. There was environmental organizations that would work with certain states to sue the EPA for failing to fulfill their statutory obligations in some senses and work to implement regulations on these industries. There was a whole host of regulations that were implemented, not just related to climate, but the mercury, air, and toxics rule, the MATS rule for power plants that helped kill off a number of coal-fired power plants, as well as a number of other regulations that were brought about by these environmental organizations, and they were very instrumental in the Environmental Protection Agency's endangerment finding that CO2 is classified as a pollutant and can be regulated under the Clean Air Act. So given their stature, and a lot of these organizations, like the Sierra Club and like the National Resources Defense Council, are not just environmental activist organizations, but they are just lawyered up in so many senses and have just teams and teams of lawyers figuring out where they can sue in state or federal courts on these premises. And so therefore, I think, it's been a fairly effective strategy for them.
I would say that I wouldn't categorize it as being one-sided or unbalanced. I think the fossil fuel industry or industry interests in general have a lot of resources to throw into the fray as well.
I would just say that
and environmental organizations and foundations have a lot of funding as well. I would just say that I think some of the things that I've been worried about at the EPA is swing too far the other way, right? You can have a conversation about how policy is made, and you can have a conversation about bringing everyone to the table. But you've seen Scott Pruitt and, for example, purge the advisory councils, the scientific advisory councils of scientists who receive funding through the EPA, supposedly for ethics rules. That actually has impacted some scientists here at OSU. We have one of our scientists is actually suing Scott Pruitt for that purge, and that actually takes away people who have expertise or are not receiving funding from industry or not receiving funding from environmental groups, but also can provide sort of scientific expertise on policy. You also have, in terms of public opinion, you actually have a realization among a large percentage of the public that the EPA is maybe swinging too far in deregulating. Recent polling by the Pew Research Center has shown that 69% of Americans, 69%, believe that the EPA, the government's doing too little to protect water quality of lakes, rivers, and streams. 64% think the government's doing too little to protect air quality. So I think, you can talk about balance and making sure that we have a right mix of industry and science and environment. But I think under Scott Pruitt, there is a perception that maybe it swung the other way too far.
What do you think, Nick?
Well, I mean, I think probably the elections will bear that out in some senses. But what the Heritage Foundation looks at is have these regulations gone too far insofar as that the cost of compliance and then passed on to the consumers is excessively high for diminishing marginal returns in terms of environmental benefits. And the MATS rule was a perfect example where it was to simply regulate mercury emissions. And most of the environmental benefits, in fact, 99.99% of the environmental benefits from that regulation came from co-benefits or regulating other sources of emissions, particularly particulate matter or PM2.5. Only 4 to 6 million of the upwards of $90 billion in environmental benefits came from mercury reduction. So I think there's a feeling that the Environmental Protection Agency and some of its regulations has gone too far, that sometimes these things don't need to be regulated at the federal level, that they can be handled at the state and local level as well. I think there's certainly a consensus that we want clean air, drinkable water, and breathable air, but the question is, who is the best to regulate that, and are we getting the right environmental returns for some of the costs of these regulations?
We are talking about the environment. We're talking about the disputes between parties in the United States, particularly. It doesn't happen everywhere around the world like it does in the United States, but the disputes over the science of the environment. My guests, you just heard from Nicholas Loris. He's an economist for the Heritage Foundation, and he focuses on energy, environmental, and regulatory issues there. And also with us, Eric Nesbitt. He is an associate professor of communication, political science, and environmental policy at Ohio State. Let us know what you think, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the issue of climate change in the U.S. in light of EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt's campaign to roll back federal regulations. Still with us, Associate Professor of Communication, Political Science, and Environmental Policy at Ohio State's School of Communication, Eric Nesbitt, and economist focusing on energy, environmental, and regulatory issues at the Heritage Foundation, Nicholas Loris. Tell us what you think, 614-292-8513. Eric Nesbitt, you wanted to talk about the Fed versus states issue when it comes to regulation.
Right. And what you're seeing is, you know, as climate change and other environmental issues and regulations, as there's changes at the federal level, you see then states responding. And a classic example is California suing the EPA to allow it to maintain so-called CAFE standards. CAFE standards are basically sort of your fuel economy standards for cars, right? Mm-hmm. How much miles you get to the gallon and emission standards. And under Scott Pruitt, the EPA is reviewing those standards that were set during the Obama administration, possibly to roll some of them back for the next model of cars starting, I think, in 2021, where you have basically California, 16 other states, and District of Columbia suing the EPA, suing the federal government to allow them to maintain CAFE standards in their states from a regulatory. So this creates this tension where you have, instead of federal regulation, you might have, as Nick was saying, well, maybe then the states pick it up mm-hmm. and they decide each state, but maybe you create then a hodgepodge of regulation nationwide when it comes to whether it's environmental regulations, air quality, or CAFE standards. The one thing about California is such a huge part of the American economy and the global economy, mm-hmm. it having certain regulatory standards, car makers aren't going to make some cars just for California and then some cars just for Montana or mm-hmm. for Georgia. So it is, you know, they may, with the other states joining the suit, if they're successful, actually create a national standard because car makers are not going to create different cars for different states. That's just not economically viable. So it creates sort of this tension and also creates a tension between states' rights and federal, right? Because it goes against, at least the federal narrative in terms of regulation, but also from an ideological perspective, what is the role of state regulation, local regulation versus federal, especially when it sort of collides when it comes to environmental issues.
Nicholas Loris, what do you think about that?
Yeah, well, I disagree with the notion that we can't have two or more different car standards. And if you look at California and what they've done in the past, they have a whole host of environmental regulatory standards for appliances that are their California Air Resources Board has promulgated and implemented that other states do not have. Mm-hmm. And manufacturers, if you go to a Home Depot, you'll see a CARB compliance sticker on a whole host of right. appliances that are not true in other states. And obviously it's different to make a leaf blower than it is a vehicle. But if there's two standards, if there's a Texas model and a California model, I think if consumers demand different cars and different vehicles, the auto manufacturers will shift to two different types of manufacturing standards. If California becomes a de facto standard, you know, that could be the case as well. But why not let a patchwork determine that? It's the auto manufacturers who are screaming against that because they don't want that because it could likely increase costs. But if it increases consumer choice, that's not necessarily a bad thing.
But the idea is, though, that the auto manufacturers can't afford to address a hodgepodge. They're going to have to go with the lowest common denominator, I guess. They're going to have to go with the one that satisfies an economy the likes of California.
We don't know that because it's never really been tested. And if California does set the standard, then, you know, the environmentalists should be happy because it's going to be a stringent standard. And then you could get into some Commerce Clause issues if California is setting the standard for the rest of the nation. But we haven't really tested that model And again, we don't know if the auto manufacturers, if it's too expensive for them. Yes, they're saying that, but that doesn't always necessarily mean it's true. They just want a simplified standard. You know, again, I think the consumers need a voice here too. And if Californians want one thing, and folks in Pennsylvania want something else, why not let the market determine if that's a viable option?
So you would, just to clarify, you would then support California's lawsuit to be able to set its own CAFE standards along with the other 16 states?
Yeah, absolutely. I have no problem with that. Again, if California wants to set its own standards, they should be able to. I think, again, where it gets a little complicated is through something along the lines of violating, you know, the Commerce Clause. And if that starts to – if California starts to regulate interstate commerce through some of these regulations. But absolutely, I think if California wants to regulate the way that it does, and if that becomes a de facto standard, then so be it.
Arlen in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Arlen.
Hey, Ann. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to state my opinion. I personally believe that a large reason that some people reject climate change is that a lot of people, at least that I've encountered, don't live a life of a scientific lifestyle. And what I mean by that is, even though a lot of people fancy themselves as quote-unquote liking science, they don't live science as a day-to-day philosophy of their life. Like, case in point, if in our cars on a sunny day, if you leave your windows up, it gets hot. And that's because of the physics driving that are things like the refractive index of light coupled with principles of thermodynamics that causes the car to get hot.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you don't understand the physics behind that, you still should be able to realize that if it's 100% possible to trap heat in a car or in a greenhouse, it's also possible for that same thing to happen to our planet. Earth isn't governed by a completely separate law of physics. So if you live a life of scientific philosophy, even if you aren't an expert on any given field, you can at least ask yourself, if X is true in this part of life, this case in point, your car getting hot with the windows up, what does that tell me about the rest of life? Again, case in point, our planet relative to a car or a greenhouse. And if you believe, and if your two beliefs don't seem to fit, you need to reconcile why they don't. So in my experience, in general, people don't live by a scientific lifestyle philosophy. And in my opinion, that's a real reason why the public has a failure to realize that climate change is real, because they don't think, if X is true, what does that mean for the rest of life?
What do you make of Arlen's observation?
Well, I appreciate his thoughts and appreciate the metaphor about the car heating up as in terms of climate. I think, unfortunately, that doesn't really fit with human nature. As humans, we tend to focus on mental shortcuts in our lives, and we're very emotional animals. And so more and more research, especially in political psychology, talks about this idea of hot cognition, that actually we often, more likely than not, have emotional responses to information, and we post hoc or rationalize those emotional responses. And so when we're exposed to information that challenges our sense of ourself or our sense of our like social or political or religious or cultural identity, we react negatively to that information, and we rationalize reasons either to accept it or to reject it, depending on how we feel, right? Mm. And that's how most people think about things. And so when it comes to denialism, and I also don't want to like put climate change denialism on a pedestal, everyone is resistant to change and new ideas in many cases. Mm-hmm. Denialism, scientific denialism, has a long history. Think about the idea that that the sun revolves around the earth, right? Think about relativity was challenged by denialism for a long period of time. So the idea is that when there are new scientific breakthroughs or discoveries or just, you know, cultural or especially have sort of cultural or political or economic implications, people are going to be resistant to that change and to sort of process that through their own sense of self or social identity. So, you know, we need to think about how, from a communication perspective, when we do encounter new information, new discoveries that might indicate some level of change, we have to think about how to reconcile that and put it in a context that people understand, and also sort of trying to dampen down sort of these inherent emotional responses we have. So it'd be nice if everyone was like completely scientific and rational mm-hmm. and deliberative, but that's just not how people think.
Nicholas Loris, what do you think? Are humans fit to make these decisions about the future of Earth?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly difficult, and I think Eric's point is very well taken. And if you look at just kind of how people become prisoners of the moment, too, I mean, Al Gore largely made An Inconvenient Truth in 2006 because Katrina was in 2005, and then we had a bit of a hurricane drought here in the continental United States, at least those major hurricanes making landfall, and people tended to care a little bit less about the issue of climate change. And you know, the last year we had a number of very intense hurricanes make landfall, and then people start to care about the issue a little bit more. I think the increased awareness of climate change has trended up, not just in the United States, but globally. But the willingness to pay for action on climate change is still very low. Mm-hmm. I mean, people may be willing to pay a dollar a month out of their electricity bill, but even then it's only about 50%. And if you hike that number up to 10 bucks a month, it drops down to 20%. So I think when it comes to what people think they want versus how much they're actually willing to pay, it becomes two very different conversations.
I think this willingness to pay also is driven by the fact that climate change for most people is still a very abstract phenomenon, right? There's a lot of psychological distance.
Well, but we only have like about 3 minutes left, and I want to talk about the point that you've made, Nicholas, and you've made, Eric, that the United States is different than the rest of the Western developed countries in its conflict over this. Now, the Paris Climate Agreement, everybody else is sticking with that, not the United States. So, Nicholas Loras, why? What makes the United States different? Is it just something in our political, socio-political makeup, or what?
Yeah, Eric may be better positioned to answer this than I am, but I do think the fact that we've had a large amount of our energy come from fossil fuels has certainly made it.
Our natural resources are so abundant.
Exactly.
Yeah,
coal,
or have been.
Oil, natural gas in a lot of red states has made it very difficult for folks to get on board. And then I also think if you have predictions just not coming true that tend to not look at the scientific trends on increased GHG emissions and global temperatures and sea level rise and things like that. But you have, former Vice President Al Gore saying that the polar caps, ice caps, would have been completely melted by 2015, and they don't come true. I think that only creates more polarization. And then you have people on the right saying it's a hoax, and that creates more polarization. So I don't know why that doesn't happen in other countries. I think they've just kind of accepted a transition to low emissions energy technologies without so much consideration about the science. But for me, this intersection, especially during the cap and trade debate a decade ago, it just really came to a head as to the role of science in climate policy, and then just simply looking at the cost of climate policy and segregating the Republicans from the Democrats.
What do you make of it, Eric?
A couple of observations. Compared to Western Europe, for example, we are much more of a center-right country. We are a more conservative country ideologically and
even
politically.
With Brexit?
Even with Brexit.
Okay, all right.
So we are more culturally, socially, politically conservative than Europe, for example. We've had more entrenched political and economic interests who are believe that climate change will be a detriment to them, that have fought back. And we have a greater polarization. And lastly, I think change is coming whether we like it or not. We live in a global interdependent world.
Uh-huh.
So technological change, economic drivers, we're not an island. So the change, a lot of companies have to think globally. So if you see changes in policy and regulation in Europe or elsewhere globally, that's going to impact us when it comes to climate change. So I think that government can play a role, but I think industry is actually changing on its own as well. I think it can be pushed further. I don't think we should necessarily forget about any type of regulation, carrot or stick, but I think change is coming. I think we just need to be vigilant and push forward if you're a climate hawk.
Eric Nisbet, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Eric Nisbet, Associate Professor of Communication, Political Science, and Environmental Policy at Ohio State School of Communication. And also Nicholas Loras, thanks to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Nicholas Loras, an economist focusing on energy, environmental, and regulatory issues at the Heritage Foundation. We're not done with this conversation, but we snipped away at a few things today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.